Your work life, all of our work lives. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco.
Even if you're well employed, LinkedIn is a valuable tool, and it is a must if you're a job seeker or a salesperson or the nonprofit analog, the fundraiser. I actually scoured worldwide to find the best expert I could. Had to go to England. Mark Williams is among the world's leading trainers in the use of LinkedIn. He's having trained over the last decade thousands of recruiters, job seekers, and people employed in how to make the most of this now essential tool. On the line with me from England is the guy that is sometimes called Mr. LinkedIn, Mark Williams. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco.
Thank you very much, Marty. Great to be here.
Good. Well, first of all, I have to, for the audience's sake, you know, it is 3 o'clock in the morning, England time, and so we all owe you a major debt of gratitude, a tip of the cap to you, sir.
Yeah, well, thank you for taking the risk of speaking to someone that might not have got up in time, so I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you.
Well, you haven't yawned yet, so it seems like you're awake.
Yeah, I'm glad this isn't television, let's just say that, because you might notice me yawning occasionally, but I'm sure I can keep that quiet on the phone.
All right. So let's get right to it. So many people who are well-employed think they needn't bother with LinkedIn because it's mainly for job seekers and salespeople. You don't think that's right. How can an employed person use LinkedIn?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting term, isn't it? Well-employed. I mean, what exactly does that mean? Put it this way, I've trained plenty of people that were well-employed until they weren't.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first point, really, is mm-hmm. that, and you know, some of these people that I've worked with, you know, they, it comes as a great surprise to them that now it's a bit harder to get the opportunities that they want because they haven't got a network. You know, their mm-hmm. network is limited to those people that they only know in person and haven't developed an online network, which puts them at a major disadvantage. So that's the first point. But, you know, I appreciate that people don't always expect that that's going to happen to them, that they're suddenly going to be in a position where they need a job. But as I say, there are many people that think that until it happens. But then over and above that, you know, we've got the strength of weak ties, the argument that says that, you know, people that are successful generally have more connections. I don't think it's necessarily that, you know, if you've got 20,000 connections, you're more successful than if you've got 10. But I do think that if you are expanding your horizons, your sphere of influence, if it were, by communicating with a wider range of people, then I think there's more opportunity potentially for you, not just in job seeking, but in all aspects of your career. People that can help you, people that can be useful to you in your current job, and in all kinds of different ways. Generally speaking, as human beings, we tend to thrive when we are in contact with other human beings. So one would assume, therefore, that if you can expand that, you know, online, then you have a greater opportunity of success. And the third point is that actually organizations these days are increasingly encouraging their employees to have better, stronger, more impressive personal brands. In fact, there is an argument that says that any organization is merely a collection of personal brands plus a corporate brand. And I think there are many HR professionals out there that very much believe in that philosophy, and that's becoming more and more important. So there is an argument to say that you're actually doing something to help your current employer by being more visible and more active on LinkedIn.
I want to push back on that on a couple of grounds. First, your latter point that that a company would want somebody to build their brand on LinkedIn, doesn't that make them more vulnerable to being poached by headhunters?
Well, it does, of course. But then again, as I often say to people, you know, this is a conversation I have with companies when, you know, I'm talking to them about training people that work for them to use LinkedIn, and they say, well, hold on a second, this means that all our staff are going to start getting headhunted. And I say, well, yeah, okay, you can either avoid your staff getting headhunted, just make sure that you employ people that aren't employable by anybody else.
Great.
You know, the reality is that if you've got good people working for you, other people are going to want them. But I wouldn't see that as a threat. I'd see that as a positive sign. I mean, honestly, I used to have people working for me, and And I used to say, so I'll be disappointed if you don't get headhunted. I mean, surely that's an indication that I'm doing something right. If my staff are getting headhunted, I just need to make sure that I'm providing you with enough opportunity and a good enough place to work that you wouldn't want to leave. So
that's very enlightened, but it's hard for me to see that much perspicacity in the typical manager who's a, you know, they've put a lot of time and energy into recruiting and training and a really competent person, and then they've got the cultural knowledge of working in the organization. And then there's certainly going to be a lot of managers are going to say, oh my God, the thought of losing that person. But anyway, the larger point is this, for the larger objection I had to your previous point is this. You talked about the power of weak ties. Well, perhaps the most important complaint I hear about from my clients about LinkedIn is that their connections, when you have, whether even if it's 200 or 500 or whatever, connections, most of them are wafer thin. They're not going to go to bat for you. They're not going to give you great tips. They may not even respond to your email. And worse, if you've got 500 plus connections, and, you know, if these days recruiters for good positions, they look at different profiles and they don't even they worry about somebody who's spent so much time on LinkedIn that they've got 500 connections, they've got 17 references, they've got 39 endorsements, they've got a long list of their accomplishments. Isn't it really not the best use of a worker's time or even a job seeker's time to spend a lot of time cultivating these weak connections?
Well, okay, so first point in terms of, you know, the collecting numbers and them not really having any real knowledge of you, so how are they going to be helpful to you? I totally agree with that, actually. I mean, I think that's a mistake that a lot of people make on LinkedIn. If you create a great profile and do the sort of tick the boxes of things that you're supposed to do on LinkedIn, all the basic stuff, then that, frankly, isn't enough. You do need to be active on LinkedIn, and by being active, that means that you are posting, commenting on other people's activities, building relationships. Now, for sure, not all of your connections, are going to bat for you. For sure, you would imagine that would be unlikely. But at the same time, you know, if you are actually putting yourself out there, being active, being seen, and being helpful, then you'd be surprised. You can actually develop pretty good relationships with people with never meeting them. You know, it's not that's not unusual. It happens all the time. In fact, I can think of many people that I have developed pretty strong relationships, even go so far as to say trusting relationships, of people that I've never met at all. But, you know, you do have to actually be active to build a stronger, more valuable network. So it's not just a case of connecting. You need to do a bit more than that.
Great. Let's get specific about that. So without it taking up all your time as a job seeker or certainly as an employed person, and you're obviously not going to try to create these relationships with your 500 or 300 or even 100 connections, what would you, Mark Williams, do to, let's say, to pick from your 100 or 150 connections, that 3, 5, 10, whatever, that you would try to build up a relationship virtually with point by point? What would you actually do?
Well, so the first thing would be that when I first connected with them, I'd start a conversation. So, you know, I'd be looking to have some kind of dialogue with them, find out a bit more about them. Now, not everybody's going to respond to that, but some people will, and that gives me an opportunity to know a bit more about them and then a bit more about me. But then after that, I think what I'd be advising people to do is to be looking for opportunities to comment, and that means that you need to, on a regular basis, every day, scan your homepage feed, have a look at what's going on, and look for opportunities to comment. If you really push for time, the odd like doesn't go unnoticed, but ideally try and comment. Now, you know, the argument back would be, well, I haven't got time for that, you know, I mean, how can I possibly do that? But the reality of that argument is, how much time does it really take? I think people blow these things out to be much more than they really are. We're talking about picking up your mobile phone, just looking at the LinkedIn app, just quickly thumbing up and down, seeing something, typing maybe a line or two once a day. Might be a matter of 1 minute every day. It's hardly a massive commitment to be able to do that. Over and above that, you would then start posting. Once you sort of the stimuli of commenting on other people's posts starts, then that starts to bring up some ideas yourself, and you start thinking about things that you might want to talk about. And LinkedIn gives you an ideal opportunity to get out there and start interacting with people about things that are genuinely of interest to you, to gather other people's opinions, start a bit of debate. All of those things help people start to form an opinion of you, both in terms of interacting with you, but of course all those other people that aren't necessarily responding but do see you and do start to understand more about you through that process.
At the very beginning of your explanation, you almost made as a fait accompli that they'll connect with you. Now, I get connections, requests for connections all the time, and unless I know the person, I'm just going to ignore it. Because, you know, do I really want the status updates from these people I don't know? How do you, before you make the ask, it's like asking somebody who's attractive to you across the room, say, do you want to have sex? It's premature. So what would be the preliminary steps in your judgment that you would make before asking someone to connect with you on LinkedIn?
There's a couple of things there. So for a start off, you need a good profile so that people can see that you're a professional, that you're serious about what you're doing, that you're interesting. All right. So again, the way that you write a profile would be a key factor in that. But I also agree that, you know, just sending someone an invitation to connect is a bit too much straight away. So the technique that I would usually advise would be to follow somebody who you decide you want to connect with. And once you follow somebody, follow people on LinkedIn, which basically means that you are able to see their activity, that then gives you the opportunity to engage with them. And so really a connection is a secondary act. It's more something that once there's been a touch point or two, then it seems appropriate to connect. It's a little bit like swapping business cards, I think. You don't just walk up to someone in a networking environment and shove your business card in their hand and then walk away, which is kind of the equivalent to how most people connect on LinkedIn. Now, what you do is you go up and you introduce yourself, you have a little chat for a while, and you say, hey, look, you know, it's been really nice to meet you. Perhaps I could leave you with my business card. And then, you know, potentially keep in touch with them from that point onwards. And so I see a LinkedIn connection as being more like that than just something that you without any thought behind it in the first place.
It seems to me that how you make the ask is also critical. If you just use LinkedIn's generic template, I'd like to connect with you, that feels very impersonal and generic. But if you don't use the default, but say, you know, I have followed you and I really like that you said this about this and we share a common interest in that, would you like to connect with me on LinkedIn? They're much more likely to say yes. Do you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's amazing the amount of people that just do not buy into that idea.
Right.
And there's a generational thing in this as well, Marty, to a certain extent. I spent a lot of time working with millennials who will say, look, it just doesn't matter. You know, it really doesn't matter. You don't need to bother about that. People don't care. And, you know, maybe in 20 years' time, everyone will be in that way orientated. But my view at the moment is that in the current situation that we're in with a wide range of people with different backgrounds on LinkedIn, you do need to take the time to personalize an invite. And, you know, I get a lot of invites every day, and I can tell you now that the ones with, you know, if I look at someone, I haven't got the time necessarily to look at their profile sometimes. So, you know, they don't personalize the invite, and they don't appear obviously suitable. It's just an ignore. You know, I haven't got the time to think about it. If someone actually personalizes the invite, then obviously they've made a bit of effort, so I'm likely to do the same back and make a bit of effort myself and then have a look at their profile and then make a decision from there. So no, you're absolutely right.
I think one of the reasons that people use the default is LinkedIn doesn't make it quite so obvious how to change from the default to a customized one. What do you, you know, I don't like to want to get into the weeds about, you know, typing in this and that, but how does one, when one wants to connect and one doesn't want to use the default but type a customized thing, what do they do?
Well, look, I mean, on desktop, it's pretty straightforward, actually, these days, anyway, with the new design of LinkedIn. As soon as you click on the button to connect, as long as you do it from the profile, there are other times when you might see someone's profile and there'll be a connect button next to their name. Never click on that, but go to the profile first, and then from the profile, there's always an option to add a note.
Right.
There isn't actually a standard invite these days. It just goes as an invite with no message at all. But that's relatively straightforward. But mobile, the app is a bit more different and a bit more tricky. I've no idea why this is the case and why they make it so different, but it is. So you do the opposite with the mobile app. You go to the profile again, but then the big blue connect button is not what you tap. Because if you do, what's going to happen is a little message will flash up and say, your invitation has been sent. So it's too late by then. So what you actually do is, sort of to the right of the connect button, you'll see three little dots which is like the more menu, and there's a number of things under that. And when you tap on that, you will see the options there to customize the invite. So a lot of people have a perception that you can't personalize on mobile because it's not that obvious, but you can. You just need to hit that little three-dot more menu.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. My guest, I have scoured the world to find what I think is the most helpful to you, my dear listeners, expert on LinkedIn. Actually, he is often called Mr. LinkedIn, Mark Williams. You're in Liverpool, is that where you are?
Cheshire, so I'm sort of in between Liverpool and Manchester.
Okay, well, you certainly have that the accent of that region of England.
Liverpool's my football club, so.
Of course you are, Manchester United. Let's talk about some of the components within you've mentioned a couple of times already the importance of a compelling LinkedIn profile, of which the headline is certainly the most visible, or more, other than your picture, which we'll talk about in a minute. But any non-obvious advice about creating a headline that's compelling?
Yeah, I mean, the first point on headlines is, it's other than your picture, the most important part of your profile. It's a bit that people are always going to see. It's a bit that gives some kind of context. So it's actually worth spending a bit of time on your headline.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, most people don't. You know, a headline is not something that when you create a profile, LinkedIn asks you for. They actually automatically fill that in for you with your job title and company name. So if you haven't changed it, it's something well worth changing.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of, headlines are covered by everyone, and it's one of those things that you probably most listeners have heard about before. So I think you're right to ask about a non-obvious tip. So what I would say is, the first thing is that if you have a small network, and one of the downsides of having a small network on LinkedIn is that you're not very visible. Without getting into the weeds on that, what it basically means is that when people search for somebody like you, because they're not going to search for you by a name because they don't know you, but if they're searching for somebody like you and you are outside of their network, which means you're not a first tier, you're not a second tier, you're not a third tier, you're beyond third tier, they can't actually see your profile. All they see is you come up in that search as a LinkedIn member. And that means you're outside of their network. Now, obviously, if they have a recruiter account or other forms of paid account, they will be able to see your name. But for most users, they won't be able to see your name. Now, and more importantly, they won't be able to see your profile. If they click on it, then it says you need to upgrade to a recruiter account to be able to see this profile. If you put your name in your headline, then they can search for you by name. And then LinkedIn works very differently, because obviously LinkedIn need to allow you the opportunity, if you meet someone networking and say, hey, we should connect on LinkedIn, just because they're outside your network, they still should let you connect to that person. So if you actually look someone up by name, you can see their full profile. Therefore, if you put your name in your headline, then that means that recruiters or whoever it might be that's looking for you can actually see your full profile. Now, that's not something I'd advise most people to do, because once you build a decent network, once you've got kind of, 500-plus connections, then that's not really going to be necessary. It's unlikely you're going to be outside of the right people, the people that you're interested in network. But certainly early days, that can be useful.
Yeah, it's a good tip. Do you really think, recruiters, not a lot, because I don't speak to recruiters that often, but some recruiters have said somebody's got 500-plus connections, it's one sign that they're a desperate job seeker. They've been picked through by lots of employers. And not to mention the fact that obviously you have 500-plus connections, you're going to be seeing a lot more status updates, requests for help, etc. Do you really recommend that people get as many as 500-plus connections?
Oh, yeah. To be honest, it's more the other way around. I would say that most recruiters, and I do speak to recruiters a lot in what I do, most of them would look at someone and go, they've got less than 500 connections, what are they doing? More that way around, to be honest, these days. The reality of it is that if you are, let's say you're not a recruiter, but you're a line manager looking to employ someone, a recruiter puts forward a candidate to you, and you look them up on LinkedIn, it's more likely that they might react that way than a recruiter, I would suggest. Even that would be unusual, but they might do. But then my argument back to them would be, okay, so, what are you're looking for someone that's kind of too cool for networking online? What is it you're looking for? Because there is no evidence here of energy, enthusiasm, proactivity. It isn't a particularly positive thing to see a LinkedIn profile with kind of cobwebs growing all over it. You actually want to see something a bit more dynamic, a bit more alive, more information that you can make a judgment from. All of that is good stuff. These are all ticks, not crosses. So, I would suggest it's unlikely that someone's going to be put off by a profile with lots of connections and also with the right kind of information and activity on it.
I don't want to beat a dead horse, but, you know, some of the most successful people I know either, A, don't want to be on LinkedIn or are really extremely selective because they're too busy. They're working, they're in demand, they just, you know, they have better uses of their time. So I do think there's a certainly, depends on at what level, but certainly at a higher level of employment, there is a price that gets paid from having a perception that you are a professional, you are a power LinkedIn user. I don't know. Anyway.
Well, I mean, all I can say in return to that is some of the most successful people in the world are on LinkedIn and do have quite impressive profiles and are pretty active. Now, I can't guarantee that it's them that's active. It might be a PA working for them.
Right.
Who knows? But, you know, if you look at the list of influencers on LinkedIn, you will see some of the top names in business in the world who are actually pretty active on LinkedIn. So I'm not sure that's true. I think there's probably an in-between stage where people, as I say, think they're successful and feel that they're kind of too good for that and don't need it anymore. But I think the harsh reality is that they haven't quite reached the heights of some of those people, you know, the Bill Gates and the Richard Bransons of this world who are active on LinkedIn. So,
okay, let's turn to the picture. What's a non-obvious, to you like my use of the non-obvious request, the non-obvious filter, what's a non-obvious tip about creating a headshot that is likely to be compelling for on LinkedIn?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, there is probably isn't a non-obvious one, because to me, a picture on LinkedIn is a pretty obvious thing, really. I mean, a close-up headshot picture is what you need, but that's obvious. You know, everyone would know that.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with pictures is that I think the non-obvious point, perhaps to some people, and the reason why you see a lot of very poor LinkedIn profile pictures and sometimes none at all, is that people don't quite understand how important it is. I mean, you know, it is the first thing we look at. I mean, you can't help yourself. It's just natural that you do that.
Yep.
And you know, as Guy Kawasaki said once in a talk that I saw him give. He said, think Tinder, not eHarmony,
right,
when it comes to any social media picture, i.e. people just look very quickly and make a quick decision. Bang. And it's the profile picture that's the first thing that you see. So it's move on, left, right, right, swipe. It's
right.
Like very, very quick decision. So it is the first thing people see. You are immediately creating a first impression through your profile picture. It needs to be professional. It needs to be a very professional close-up headshot.
Yeah, there I completely agree. And there, I think I just read a Psychology Today article a couple of days ago that said that people do make a relatively indelible judgment about somebody in the first one-tenth of a second. So, and in internet time, when they're looking, when a recruiter, for example, is looking through an internet profile, they're giving you a tenth of a second. I want to try to do a little brain dump of what I think are some potentially not obvious keys to a good picture. And you tell me if you agree, disagree, or amplify. So, first of all, I don't think you need to have a professional do it because you're going to be tighter. There are subtle little cues in that tenth of a second. If a professional is doing it, unless you're so used to having your picture taken, you could somehow seem tight. I would rather have either a selfie or a really good friend who you really trust, a romantic partner, whatever, do the picture taking. And the keys to that, what a professional would do that ends up being important, is no shadows on your face because that makes you look sinister. And I think in general, some people look better when they have a big, broad smile. Some people look better when they're serious. There's no right or wrong, and it also depends on the kind of job. If you're in marketing and communications, then maybe big smiley works better. If you're an artificial intelligence programmer or competitive intelligence analyst, you may not need that big smile, and it may seem phony and artificial. I'll stop there. What do you think about those ideas?
Yeah, I'm not sure I agree with that. I think I don't think you have to pay for a professional to take your photograph, but I think that the advantages are often misunderstood. It's not so much about the equipment and the lighting to stop the shadows and all the rest of it. Although all those things are important and things that a good photographer will do, the important thing about a good photographer, two things they do. One is that they get you looking good. So as long as your brief is right, and you know it's only as good as the information that you give them, so they know where you're operating, what kind of environment you're in, what image you want to be portraying, what your personal brand is. And the second thing they do is to take lots of pictures, which is kind of combined with the first one, really. one of the things that when people take pictures themselves is typically, and I don't agree about selfies, I think you have to be very careful with a selfie. You have to do it in a way that shows that it's not a selfie. I think it's better to get a friend to take a picture. But either way, whether it's you or a friend, what you'll probably do is take one or two and then pick from that. A professional photographer will probably take 50. And they'll just bang off loads and loads of pictures, which is why, in that selection of 50, they're more likely to get one that you look at and go, yeah, that's a really good representation of me, and I'm really happy with that one. So, generally, I usually advise people, if they can, it's not a particularly expensive thing, to get a professional to take it. If not, get a friend to take it. Make sure that there's nothing in the background. Make sure that if they are using, an SLR, a decent camera, that they're using one with depth of field that means that the background is out of focus, because the focus really needs to be very much on you.
Well, I'll say, for what it's worth, today's phones have such great cameras built into them that an SLR becomes unnecessary, but I certainly agree that taking 10, 20, 30, 50, 100 images, all with different kind of smiles and different kind of expressions, and if they're close enough, you're not, those, even your phone cameras have the right f-stops automatically built in so that they will focus primarily on your face. But let's go from there. Let's go to the summary section, which is the next critical section in a LinkedIn profile. Anything non-obvious you want to give us as a tip for how to create a great summary?
Yeah, well, somebody's changed, actually, with the new design of LinkedIn that came in last year. The summary's actually become more important, and it's also changed in its design. So now it's right at the top of the profile. You used to have to scroll down to it, whereas now you almost always see it straight away since you go to a profile. Mm-hmm. But you only see a certain amount. So if you're looking on mobile, you actually only really see about the first 40, 45 characters. So, depending on why you're using LinkedIn, but if you want to be available to be contacted, remember that people on LinkedIn can't contact you unless they have a premium account. So my advice is to get your contact details in the first 45 characters. Mm. Start with that, because if someone sees you on mobile, that's all they're going to see, right?
Good point.
Now, you might, again, it depends on why you're using LinkedIn. You may get a bit of spam by doing that, for sure. So it's whether the advantages outweigh the disadvantages. Mm-hmm. But it's certainly for a job seeker, for instance, can be a very useful tip. The other bit is if you look on desktop, you see more than 45 characters. You see about 220, mm-hmm. something like that. But it's the first two lines, in effect. Mm-hmm. So you've got to be aware that those first two lines should be designed, apart from your contact details, should be designed to get someone to click on mm-hmm. see more. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, on the internet, it's harder to get someone to click than it is to get them to scroll. So the chances are they might scroll past this. If you don't do something that makes them want to go, I want to read that. So your first two lines should mm-hmm. be designed to get someone to want to open out the rest. So like a teaser, if you like.
Yep.
And, I'm a great fan of stories. I think stories mm-hmm. are very sticky. So mm-hmm. if you are trying to demonstrate something about yourself, rather than tell people, just tell people the story that yep. demonstrates it for you, if you like. And that also helps with making your headline a teaser, because you can start the story in the first two lines and make it irresistible to the reader to want to know what the rest of the story is.
Great. Can you give me an example of a story? Many of the listeners to this show don't like the corporate sector. They work in the nonprofit or government sector. If they were, let's say, a fundraiser, because money is the lifeblood of nonprofits, what kind of a story could they tell that at least starts in those first 220 characters?
An example probably easiest to give you off the top of my head at 3 o'clock in the morning is my profile. So in my profile, I tell a story about when I first started as a LinkedIn trainer back in the day. And in those days, this is 2008, so there weren't that many LinkedIn trainers out there. It was a bit of an idea that I had. I wasn't really sure whether it was going to take off or not. LinkedIn was about 40 million people at that stage, if I remember rightly. So I decided that, having planned the business and everything, I was going to go and network in person, just to test the theory. So I was going to meet people, I was going to speak to them, I was going to say to them, this is what I do, and just see how they reacted to that, right? First person I met was a partner of a law firm, and cut a long story short, basically, when I told him that I was a LinkedIn trainer, he said to me, I know LinkedIn, I'm on LinkedIn, I never use it, but I'm on it. Interesting. What else do you do, Mark?
Right.
And I said, that's what I do. I'm a LinkedIn trainer. And then at that point, he laughed so loud that everyone else in the room looked round and wondered what was so funny. And the point being that it made me feel pretty small. And it also seriously concerned me that maybe I was onto, you know, I was thinking to myself, as I was driving home that night, I remember thinking, what was I thinking? Why did I think this was such a great business idea? And it really destroyed my confidence for a short while. But then I went to bed, got up the next morning, completely different mindset, and I thought, what does he know? You know, he admitted he's never on LinkedIn. He doesn't understand the opportunities. I'm going to let him put me off. And it actually gave me some determination and drive to make it happen. And that's the story that I tell in my headline. But I started, the kind of teaser part of it is, you know, I explain what I am and I say, but I nearly gave up after a month. Click Seymour to find out why. So, you know, the story is a story that demonstrates something about my character and is a real story of something that actually happened to me. So, you know, thinking about times in your career when there's been sort of pivotal moments that actually really demonstrate something about who you are.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. I'm talking with Mark Williams, also known as Mr. LinkedIn. We are talking kind of an advanced course in how to make the most of LinkedIn. Is there a, you know, you talked earlier about the importance of participating. I think I'm going to pass on that because we already discussed it and I'm looking at the clock. So one of the great things about LinkedIn that some people don't remember or don't use is that it's fabulous for finding people with specific characteristics in the right career, the right company, the right geography, who may even have attended your high school. Walk me through how you can use LinkedIn to find not the a person you know, but somebody who's got this wonderful constellation of characteristics that would make them want to connect with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Search is such a powerful part of LinkedIn. It's one of the areas that when I'm showing people why they perhaps need to have LinkedIn training, is one of the things I show them is search, because it often really opens people's eyes to what could be done. So, okay, let me talk you through as well as I can without demonstrating exactly how this works. So there's actually two ways of finding people on LinkedIn. Well, there's a number of different ways, but I guess there's two main ways in terms of search. One, you mentioned school before. I'll just quickly talk about alumni. And there's a section of a LinkedIn called alumni that people don't often know about. So in the tips that other people haven't heard before, this one might fit into that category. So if you go to, let's say, your own profile, go down to your education section, go to your school, click on that, there'll be a page for that school. And then right at the top of that page for that school, it says, see alumni from this school. Click on that, and that is a totally different search to the normal search on LinkedIn. And within that, you can filter that search to find people. So you might say, let's find people who went to my school that are in my area, for instance. Or in my industry, and things like that. So that can be a nice introduction to someone, and you might actually find someone in there that you either know or certainly have enough in common with to perhaps use the fact that you went to the same school as an initial point.
Right.
That's one area of search. The normal search, though, is you go to the top of the page, there's a search bar at the top there, and you can put keywords in there to search, but that... there's not a lot of control over that. What happens if you do that is that searches the whole profile. Really what you want to do is search for people with filters. Now, these days, they've changed the design recently, but if you click on it, you'll see it gives you three options, one of which is people, so you select that. When you then do that, that takes you into a different page, and in that page, on the right-hand side, you've got a great long list of filters. And in those filters, you can search for a variety of things, such as location, industry, even connections of, you know, Marty, these days you can actually go, show me people that are connections of, and that would need to be someone that you're connected to. So in effect, you're searching your connections by adding that filter into the search as well. So now, on the most important filter on the right-hand side is called keywords. It's what often people don't click on because they think, well, you know, I'm not interested in putting keywords in my search, but actually it's more than keywords. When you open it out, you've got a variety of fields in there, and the most important one of all being title. So, you know, if you're looking to find someone, you don't know their name, then, you know, well, I'm looking for her, it's going to be a job title, isn't it? So that gives you the opportunity to put a job title in there, but you have to be careful. Now, this is a trick that recruiters will use. Of course, yeah, job titles are, You know, you can get one company, someone do exactly the same job in another company, have a completely different job title.
Sure.
You know? Many, many years ago, I used to work in recruitment, and I used to deal with personnel officers who then became HR professionals, who then became recruiters, who these days are called talent acquisition
right.
specialists.
Right. I know.
And of course, that's all the same job. So
right.
what you do is you write, you know, a simple Boolean string, and really just the simple rule on this is just use the word or in capital. So job title, if that's multiple words, which it normally is, put it in quotation marks, and then the word or in capitals, then another job title, then the word or, then another job title, and on you go from there. That's a very powerful field, and that really helps you to be able to find sort of people that you're going to be looking for.
Absolutely. And, you know, at the top of the show, I tease the fact that you don't have to be a job seeker to be looking. People who are employed as salespeople or that the nonprofit analog of salespeople, which is a fundraiser, they can use both the people search, as you described, as well as company. They can do the company search. Anything you want to ask about, tell us about that, or should we move on to the next topic?
Well, one thing I would say in terms of salespeople, a great tip for salespeople using LinkedIn search is, and you know, this could be applicable for others as well, but particularly for salespeople, what you can do is set up what's called a search alert. This is a free service. You can have 3 search alerts on a free account. What that means is that when you've done what I've just described and you've set up your search and you're happy, you've done all the filtering, you're happy with that result, take that string of job titles that are in the keyword job title field, copy them, leave them in the field, right? Mm-hmm. Just copy them, and then go back up to that initial field at the top left. Put them in there as well, and then click on search. Now, what you're doing is giving yourself pretty much the same search result. It'll be very, very similar, but you have to do that to trigger the search alert feature. Mm-hmm. Without anything in that top bar, it doesn't appear. But once you put it up there, and repeating something that you've already put in the search elsewhere, then it will appear in the right-hand side. And the search alerts are fantastic because what they do is they will email you every week with a list of new people that meet the criteria
right.
of your search. Now, just think about this from a sales perspective. So what I've done is I've built a prospect list based on job title and all the rest of it. I've got these people in my list. Now, and that's useful to me, and I'm going to start speaking to these people. But then from that point onwards, LinkedIn every week is going to email me with hot leads. It's going to go, look, here's someone who has, it won't be new to LinkedIn, that doesn't happen that often these days, but it'll be someone who's changed their profile because they've been promoted, because they've moved to the area. Whatever the criteria is, they've changed their job title to one that suits the one that you're looking for, which means they're probably new in a job. And that's a massive opportunity. That's a real lead for you to then follow up on. So,
golden indeed. So let's come full circle. Of course, LinkedIn is most heavily used by job seekers, and indeed alerts as well as LinkedIn job ads are obviously of value to the job seeker. Anything you want to tell us not obvious about LinkedIn job ads or alerts?
Yeah, I mean, it's a section that... that has developed quite a lot, actually, and LinkedIn do put a lot of effort into this because this is where they make most of their money.
Right.
So, you know, recruitment's very important to LinkedIn. So anything recruit-related, they tend to put a bit more energy into, I find.
Right.
I mean, one thing I would say there, Marty, actually, I wouldn't agree that it's mostly used by job seekers at all. That was the case maybe 5 years ago. Not these days at all. I would say job seekers on LinkedIn are a minority. But anyway... the job section is much better than it used to be. You've got all kinds of filters across the top, and you can create alerts as well. So you can do your search, specify exactly what you're looking for, et cetera, and then get it to alert you, and similar to what I just described with normal search, about any jobs that come up. But if you're looking for a tip that perhaps is an unusual one on this, this is something that I usually advise people to do. And it's not going to suit everyone, but might be useful to some people listening. There is a filter. Well, this is how you would create this to happen. On the filters at the top, one of the filters is date posted. Mm-hmm. And have that set at any time. You can have it set at, you know, literally in the last week. But have it set at any time. And then under, and there's a filter called LinkedIn Features, which is a slightly unusual title and not necessarily, and a bit misleading in a way. But in that one, you can see there is a filter for under 10 applicants.
Mm.
Now, then what you do is you sort the meaning that it gives you the most recent first, and then scroll right down to the bottom. So what you're getting there is jobs that have been posted a while ago, and there are still only 10 applicants. And you might find something in there that's attractive, and you know that your competition is low. And you know there's a chance that perhaps that's a company that is struggling to fill. So it might be that that's a job that you considered applying for and then thought, I don't really have the right background, I'm not quite the perfect candidate, I doubt I'd have any chance of getting that. So you didn't apply. But this is now a situation where potentially that employer is struggling to fill that job. So play on that, contact them as a not ideal candidate, and they may well be more open to you than you might have first thought.
I do think that's a great tip, but I would add, if a job has been posted a long time and it's gotten less than 10 applicants, it's often one of two things. It often means the job's requirements are so stiff that very few people could meet it, probably including you. Also, that the insiders, anybody who knows this company or that boss, knows that that's a horrible company or a horrible nonprofit or a horrible boss. And so you need to, during the interview process, really take great care to vet them, asking the right questions in the interview to get a sense of what they're like, checking them out on Glassdoor. And then when you're offered the job, to come in to negotiate terms and also to check out the workplace and perhaps talk to people in the workroom so you don't end up with a job that is really a terrible job. Does that make sense?
I totally agree, but it's not a reason to not apply, right?
Right. No, agree.
Yeah, so you assess it as you go along. I mean, I think the other reason might be that it could just be a job that has been filled and they just haven't taken it off LinkedIn. I think when you do that process, you'll probably find that there'll be some that aren't actually really active when they look like perhaps they are. But yeah, I mean, you know, it may open up opportunities. It's not going to suit everyone, but you know, it's just a little feature within the job search that's quite unusual and perhaps an angle that people wouldn't have thought of before.
Well, you certainly were unusual in your willingness to get up at 2:45 in the morning GMT and be not only awake, but you were truly everything I would have hoped for. So, Mark Williams, let me just end with a softball. What would you like to tell people? Your website, something you want them to read? What would you like to plug, as they say?
Well, I mean, feel free to go to my LinkedIn profile, which there's a lot of Mark Williamses on LinkedIn.
Right.
The easiest way to go to my profile is linkedin.com/in/MrLinkedIn. Website is winbusinessin.com. But, you know, the links to that and everything else is all in my LinkedIn profile. So that's probably the best place. And feel free to connect with me. But obviously, it would be crazy to not personalize the invite.
Exactly.
And mention, obviously, in that invite that you've heard me on this show.
Yeah, because people are listening in the radio, they're usually not jotting things down. I am going to, the website is a shorter URL, and so I'm going to say it now slowly. It's winbusinessin.com. One word, winbusinessin.com. And from there, I'm sure you can find Mark Williams's LinkedIn profile.
Sure.
And again, Mark Williams, thanks so much for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemko.
It's a pleasure.
Great. Sleep. Go back to sleep now, would you please?
I will do.
Good night.
Have a great evening.
Right.
Bye-bye.
Bye. And now we turn to you. I was weighing whether we should invite you to call in with him on the air, but I was afraid we would get more in the weeds of, you know, the details of how to search that may not be the best use of your time. I wanted to make sure I had at least a little time to do what is a core part of this show here at Work with Marty Nemko and KALW, and that is workovers. If you or someone you care about has a work-related problem, perhaps you're maybe 30, 40, 50, 70, and still don't know what you want to be when you grow up, I do, in a workover, I will ask you some questions and try to help give you some ideas that perhaps you hadn't thought about. Or maybe you know what you want to do, but you're having trouble landing the job, or you're on the job, whether you're a clerk or a CEO, and you're unhappy for one or more reasons. Any of those reasons is a good reason to call for a workover. Again, the price is right, zero, thanks to KELW and me. I'm volunteering here at KELW for now in my 29th year. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko and KELW, 415 841 4134. That's the number to call if you'd like some career advice. 415-841-4134. And since I've been moved to this new, better time here, Thursday nights at 7, I've been trying to go back to basics, because many of the listeners really like knowing about careers that may be a little more under the radar. And so I want to share some of those with you now. I've given short shrift to careers that are hands-on. You know, I've focused on a lot on science, math careers, word careers, people careers, but not so much the hands-on. And one of the more certainly growing careers that are stable and unlikely to require 5 years of school is something called a diagnostic imaging technician. I'll say it this way. These imaging jobs, they are among the least expensive of diagnostic tests. They're not invasive. So you may be doing basic X-rays or fluoroscopes or sonograms or CAT scans, as well as the higher resolution MRIs, PET scans, CT scans, and no doubt those are going to keep improving and therefore create jobs as a way of avoiding those expensive invasive tests. And so that's just kind of a career that's an under-the-radar career. Everybody thinks about healthcare and they want to be doctors and nurses and the like. But diagnostic imaging technician is not a bad career. One little secret about that, unfortunately, is many people who are getting those tests, some of them are older and heavy and hard to move. And so you normally need to be pretty, you know, have a good back and be able to help position patients. And you also need to keep patients calm and still, you know, when you're taking an image of somebody, if they're moving, it's, you know, it's going to be fuzzy. So, but it's an interesting career for a hands-on type, because you only need a little people skills, but basically you're operating a machine. Another example of a healthcare-related hands-on career is what's called a biological technologist. They often call it a lab tech. But again, as the U.S. is moving toward, quote, covering everyone, there's ever greater cost-control pressures. Because there's going to be a large percentage of the people who are covered who currently aren't are low pay and high need people. And so the use of, you know, blood and urine and tissue samples are going to be a lower cost way of doing diagnosis than invasive tests. And because the field is ever changing and these biological technologists are usually get to rotate across test types, it can be quite an interesting career. And, of course, they also work in not just in clinical, that is, to, you know, helping patients who are being diagnosed with some disease or lack thereof. They also work in research labs, for example, using DNA samples from humans, from other animals, from plants. So biological technologist is a kind of an under-the-radar, hands-on career in the healthcare space. I'll give out the phone number again. If you or someone you care about has got a work-related problem, you'd like a workover, the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And I think I'll just wait a few seconds and we'll go right to the phones. Yes, let's go to the phones. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hey, how you doing, Marty?
I am well. What gives me the honor of the call?
So actually, I'm calling on behalf of my wife. Okay. We're both in our early 30s. Mm-hmm. She works in journalism magazines and on the creative side. Mm-hmm. And with the nature of, and actually the paper aspects of it, you know, and a little bit of the digital, with that being a shrinking industry, mm-hmm. you know, she's had a little trouble finding the next step for her moving forward.
Right.
So I don't know exactly. I've talked to her about maybe doing some career consultant stuff so where she can meet with somebody and maybe get some more direction, but I thought you might have some insight just from all your years of experience.
Certainly. Well, you know, when the Chronicle laid off most of its people, most of them went to do one of two things. They worked usually in corporate or nonprofit communications departments, because one of the fastest growing fields over the last few years has been marketing and marketing communications. So depending upon her background and maybe specialization or expertise, she might go and try to go that route. I had a number of my clients who were journalists at the Chronicle who ended up working for Kaiser Permanente in their marketing departments or marketing communication, external or internal. And of course, because of the Bay Area kind of and people who are journalists tend to have non-profit values. Those are the people who tend to go into journalism. So, you know, the Bay Area is the epicenter for the world of nonprofits. So if she's got some expertise or interest in a particular nonprofit area, that might be logical next steps. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. And sort of as a follow-up, a lot of the jobs she has been interested in seem to be getting filled, she finds out after the fact, by sort of people that are younger and more, I think, willing to accept the entry-level salaries.
Absolutely.
Any sort of advice on how to overcome that kind of...
Absolutely. Look, you know, the real unvarnished truth is, you know, I've written 20 essays for Time Magazine's prestigious ideas section, and I'm not shy about negotiating. And when I ask them to get paid, they say, take it or leave it. A million people would want to write for you. Huffington Post pays zero. You know, they talk about treating labor fairly, but then they pay their work, most of their writers zero. So, and so there's relatively few jobs that pay really well, and they almost always, because writing, as important a skill it is a widely held skill as opposed to, for example, advanced artificial intelligence programming. And so, unfortunately, and I despise this, I really wish we lived in a meritocracy, but the reality is that not all, but many of the good jobs do go to people who know people. So, unfortunately, as my previous guest, the LinkedIn expert, said, it is critical. I'm not so sure I'd be putting most of my effort into LinkedIn, but I would be doing what I could for her to systematically, and that's one of my favorite words these days around job search, systematically try to build existing relationships or develop new ones with people in the power to hire you who are older. Because if they themselves are 25, we say we celebrate diversity, but that's a lie. We tend to like people like ourselves. So if she's in her 30s or 40s, and she's a woman, and we really are, I mean, it was Madeleine Albright who said there's a special place in hell for sisters who don't help sisters. So especially here in the Bay Area, especially given the Me Too movement, there is a tremendous general... That's too strong. There is a... Certainly, it is easier normally to get hired if you're a woman by connecting and networking with women and who are in a position of power who may have a title like Director of Communications or Vice President of Marketing Communications or Investor Relations, which is a communication job. So finding people, male or female, but certainly, you know, as a tipper, it would not hurt to focus on women who are in their 30s, 40s, 50s, or heaven forbid, 60s, who are still working. They would have greater power to hire people at a good salary. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Well, I thank you for calling Work with Marty Nemko.
Thanks. Take care.
Take care. You too. So I like to think I helped him, and I want to be able to help you. So if you have a work-related problem of any sort, I've been doing this now in my 29th year, so I've heard it all. I'm happy to share with you. This is my pro bono work. This is what I do as volunteering to help folks who don't want to see me and pay my, not so high, but my, you know, my fees. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Before we went to the phones, I was sharing some careers that are hands-on oriented, that are perhaps under the radar. One that is maybe not so under the radar, but it's really important. So many people who have called into the show in the past, and who, you know, again, one of the other things that the Bay Area is known for is not just its nonprofit sensibilities, but artistic sensibilities. So there's a million people who want to be artists and graphic designers. The reality is that much of that work is being offshored. But there are good remaining U.S. jobs. They tend to require a trio of skills. Yes, hand drawing. You just can't use Illustrator and After Effects and, you know, Photoshop. You've got to have hand drawing skills, and you've got to know that software, and you have to, importantly, which is often missing, you have to have a business sense, where you use your intuition as well as translating market research data into compelling ads, product labels and logos, things like that. Those kind of, with that triad of skills, that is hand drawing, yes, software skills, and a business sense, that makes you more hireable than your garden variety graphic artist. And now let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
Hello?
Hi, it is you.
Hi, Marty. It is me. How you doing?
I am well. What gives me the honor of the call?
I'm calling on behalf of a good friend of mine who is a a transit planner in the Bay Area.
Right.
And he's been doing it for about 10 years, and he's very good at his job. He actually cares about the community and what he's doing and likes to make a difference. And his main issue is, I guess, working with kind of the government bureaucracy the way that mm-hmm. it is, and that a lot of the jobs that he gets, they don't seem to really, care about the greater picture, or that he gets with people who he's well exceeded their abilities but can't seem to get in those higher positions. He just actually landed his first management position, but it's really a small company, and the immediate director is someone who's never had any experience in the area and somehow, you know, fell into that position, and doesn't, like, the whole community doesn't respond to emails, doesn't respond to meetings. It's just a very strange environment that he's been.
Indeed, I'm seeing again and again.
Trying to find a location where you can, you know, add something.
Right. I really, it's so sad. I've said this before on the radio. The rudeness of people today not responding. They all claim to be humanistic and caring, but then they don't even answer emails. Even my job seekers who've had two or three interviews, sometimes the employer doesn't even give them a response, let alone feedback. You know, it's outrageous. But in any case, normally, if he is more competent than the people who he had been working with before, then he needs to really be upwardly aspiring. Very often when you're not getting feedback or whatever, you're feeling depressed and like nobody cares about you, or that you're really not that good, he should find the most prestigious organizations, whether they be for-profit or non-profit or whatever, and he needs to reach out to them, whether it be through the old traditional answering ads or maybe giving a talk at a conference, can strut his stuff if he's a public speaker type person, if he's a writer, writing a white paper about his visions for transportation, but doing something like that. But I must say, I understand most transportation planners today at least say we need to get out of our cars because it's environmentally responsible. You can't build more freeways. But I look at the human pain that people face in their commutes, adding an hour or two a day because mass transit just doesn't go far enough, because even that will take 4 hours a day. The pain that people suffer not only in their commutes but in visiting friends. Or in, like I've said before on the radio, I have a 90-year-old friend whom I love. He was my former doctoral advisor. He lives in Marin. I live in Oakland. It's 2 hours to get there, even on a weekend.
Yeah.
We need to consider, yes, the potential environmental benefits, but the 100% guaranteed human toll that not building freeways imposes on people, because mass transit only does so much for what it's worth. Anyway, those are my thoughts, but I hope that, aiming high in his case sounds like the wise thing to do, both trying to get the job through the front door, that is answering ads, but also networking, giving speeches, writing talks, letting him strut his competency, his stuff. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your help.
You're most welcome. And that is Work with Marty Nemko for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Thursday at 7. You can call in for a workover, plus the art of managing people, hiring, training, and motivating. Until then, this is Marty Nemko reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.